All right, let's continue now talking about the complete oxidation of glucose, which is how we get the maximum amount of energy out of our fuels. Glucose is the master fuel. In slide 6, we see a reaction, but this is not a complete molecule, obviously, right? Either this one or this one, because they have these uncompleted bonds. That's because this is showing you just one of the carbons and associated atoms of 6 that are in glucose. Actually, this wouldn't even have to be glucose. It could be another fuel. But the point is that when we extract energy from our fuels, including glucose, what we do is pick off the hydrogens. The complete oxidation of glucose involves really two things when you get down to what happens to the fuel itself. We completely dismantle the carbon skeleton. That's why you start with 1 6 carbon glucose and you end up with 6 single carbon dioxides. Plus, we take off all the hydrogens because those carbon-hydrogen bonds are where useful energy is. And this is just one, then, of the 6 carbons in glucose. But the same thing would happen to all of them, basically, is what this is saying. This is a reaction like virtually all in biochemistry that is catalyzed by an enzyme. We know that this is an enzyme for a couple reasons. One is that it's not drawn on either side of the arrow, right, because it's not a reactant. Also, we know it's an enzyme because of its name, right? It ends in A-S-E, which tells you that that's an enzyme's name. And enzymes, in general, there are exceptions, but enzymes are usually named either for the specific substrate that they're able to help turn into product, or they're named for what they do, what process they help out in. And that's true for this one. This is named for the fact that it accelerates the reaction we're looking at here, which is dehydrogenation. To dehydrogenate means to pick the hydrogens off of the fuel. And that's how we get the useful energy out of it. So this is catalyzed by dehydrogenase enzymes, and it is another example of redox. Just like when I showed you the redox example with methane. Or did we go through the methane one yet? Can't remember whether that's coming up or not. Anyway, this is a redox reaction, and in any given redox reaction, of course, something has to be reduced, something has to be oxidized. But when we're talking about fuels, using fuels, meaning extracting energy from them, it's always the fuel that is oxidized. And in the case of what we're looking at here, the hydrogens that get picked off of that fuel are the source of the electrons that qualify for it being oxidized. It's the fuel is being depleted of electrons because you're picking off hydrogens. That's what makes it oxidized. Well, in any redox reaction, something is oxidized only if something else is reduced, right? So, in other words, those electrons have to go somewhere. They don't just cease to exist. And that's where this NAD thing comes into play, which we haven't talked about yet. NAD is not a chemical formula. There aren't symbols on the periodic table like that, right? So it's an acronym. It stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And if you look at its whole name, rather than just the letters, what does this tell you this thing is? What's it made of? Exactly. It's a dinucleotide. ATP, remember, is a nucleotide. It's an energy-carrying molecule. Well, this is also an energy-carrying molecule, but it's made out of 2 nucleotides. And we'll look at the structure and why the name makes sense in a different slide. But NAD is not only another energy-carrying molecule, it qualifies as a coenzyme. There are two important coenzymes involved in this whole process of the complete oxidation of glucose. NAD is used more often than the other one, but we'll see a very highly related one later that's also a dinucleotide. Anyway, that's what NAD stands for. That's the name of the molecule. But it's an energy-carrying molecule just like ATP is, except that ATP, if you want to think of in terms of goals, is the goal, right? ATP is what we want to store the energy that gets extracted from the fuel into. Temporarily, of course, because ATP is not good in its own right. It's useful because it's versatile. The energy that's put into ATP can then be released to power any number of endergonic reactions that the cell has to have happen. So that's why it's the goal in terms of burning the fuel. We want to burn the fuel to make as many ATP molecules as possible. But NAD carries energy as well. It's just not the ultimate goal of this process. So the energy that is carried by NAD, and this happens in several different places in the overall process, is eventually going to be put elsewhere and become part of the energy that's in more ATP. Okay, so it's an energy-carrying molecule that carries energy around for the purpose of eventually delivering it to the process of making more ATP. Coenzymes in general are things that carry things from one place to another. They help enzymes out. And so since these things are carrying things around and dropping them off, I want you to think of these NADs as little taxis. You know, a real taxi doesn't really have any true destination, right? A taxi is just always picking passengers up, delivering them somewhere, and then going and getting more passengers. That's exactly how NAD operates in cells. And just like a real taxi, there is an empty version when the taxi does not have a passenger, and there's a full version. All right. Well, the passenger, in the case of NAD, is energy in the form of electrons from the fuel. And so when we dehydrogenate a fuel, which is what this reaction is showing you happens, we're taking energy from the fuel in the form of those hydrogen atoms, which include electrons. Right? Each hydrogen atom includes an electron. And those get carried around as passengers by these coenzymes, including NAD. But that, just like a real taxi, they're not going to stay in there forever. They're going to get delivered somewhere else. While they're carrying the passengers, though, since these electrons represent energy from the fuel, the taxi that has passengers, it is at a much higher energy level than the empty taxi. But in terms of redox, since the passengers are electrons, how would you describe the taxi that has the passengers?
Positive charge?
Reduced, yes. Negative charge, actually, because electrons are negative. But yes, they are the reduced version. So just like a taxi has two versions, empty and full of passengers, so does this coenzyme. It can be either oxidized or reduced. Oxidized is the empty taxi because it does not have the extra electron that's carrying around, right? The reduced form is the full taxi, full at the moment because it's already carrying the passengers. And make sure you have it straight in your mind that the reduced version, by virtue of carrying those energetic electrons, is a much higher energy carrying molecule. I mean, it's carrying a lot more energy than the empty taxi is. It's the high energy version, the reduced version is. Is that a question?
Yeah, I'm just confused about the coenzyme. Is it like speeding up a reaction? Is that why it has that name?
It's involved with delivering things to the enzyme.
Oh.
So the enzyme itself requires this helper, basically, for the process. Okay, now, NAD is listed here twice, but in two versions. One is the oxidized form and one is the reduced form. Which would you expect to be on the left? Where you have the fuel still having the electrons. This is the fuel, right? The electrons are in the hydrogen atoms, and they're still on the fuel, so which version of the taxi is this?
Oxidized.
This is the empty one. It hasn't yet picked up the hydrogens. Okay, those hydrogens are going to be the passengers. Now, there are two hydrogens on this piece. This is just one of six pieces of the glucose. But there's two hydrogens involved here, and they're both going to be picked off with the help of this dehydrogenase enzyme. But if you think about two entire hydrogen atoms, what do you have as a list of subatomic particles? Therefore, two electrons and two protons. Right? If you have two hydrogen atoms, but you don't think of them as atoms, you think of them just as particles, you have two electrons and two protons. Those came from the fuel. Okay? But it's two of each. Now notice that the empty taxi, the oxidized coenzyme, is NAD+. If you take one of those electrons and add it, that would neutralize it and make it NAD. That makes sense? Now you still have an electron and two protons that we haven't talked about. So if you take that second electron and one of the protons, those together make up a hydrogen atom. And if you also add that to the taxi, that would make it NADH. But you still have an extra proton that can't fit in the taxi. But it's still there. It's now in solution. That's why we list, or that's why we use as a symbol for the reduced form of NAD, NADH plus NH plus, a proton that's just by itself. That all makes sense? And that is not only the higher energy version of NAD, NADH and H plus is the higher energy reduced form. It actually is carrying so much energy, much more than ATP. It's carrying enough energy to eventually, once it delivers this energy elsewhere, produce multiple ATPs. So it's very high energy molecule, important in the process. All right, now let's look at NAD and make sense of its name. Keep in mind what a single nucleotide has to include to be a nucleotide. It has to have a pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and at least one phosphate, right? So this thing is a nucleotide, and so is this thing. You have two nucleotides here, right? This one is what we've looked at before. This is ribose and adenine. So this is an adenine-based nucleotide. This is a nucleotide with a non-conventional nitrogenous base. It's not one of the four that are usually used in RNA or for the four that are used in DNA, but it's still a nitrogenous base. This white part, just the nitrogenous base itself, is nicotinamide. And so this particular nucleotide that nicotinamide is part of is a nicotinamide nucleotide. This is an adenine nucleotide. And when you sew the two together by hooking their phosphates, you have a dinucleotide, specifically a nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. That explains the name. The business end of this whole thing, though, is the nicotinamide part of it, because that's the part that can either receive or drop off two electrons and a proton that we just talked about in the previous slide. In other words, that's the part that either gets reduced or oxidized. And on the right, you would have all of this stuff that just isn't repeated. They're just showing you that really the part that matters here is the nicotinamide nitrogenous base. But just like I was talking about before, you really have two electrons and two protons from the two hydrogens that got taken off the fuel, but only three of those particles fit onto the nicotinamide. It's two electrons and one of the protons. The other proton is in solution.
So does the electron from that proton on the far right go to
this electron?
Because there's two electrons, so one, can I go up and show you what I'm talking
about? Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sense in my head. So you said there was two electrons, so there's two H's, right?
Yeah, two electrons and two protons.
This is oxidized right here. And this is reduced, so does the electron go right here, and then it's just a proton left over? Is that what happens?
Well, that's what I was saying on the previous slide. Mm-hmm. One of the two electrons makes this neutral instead of positive.
Okay.
And then the other one also gets hooked on along with a proton in the form of a hydrogen atom.
Okay.
Right? This hydrogen atom is another electron plus a proton.
Okay.
That's one of the protons.
Yes. Okay.
And then the other one is by itself.
It
is, though, but does now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's go to 8. We talked about combustion already, and combustion is reaction of fuel with oxygen, right? If it's a organic fuel that is combusted, then the products, as we've talked about, are carbon dioxide and water. Well, hydrogen is also a fuel, though. And it, of course, isn't going to make carbon dioxide because there's no carbon in it. But it will make water. If we had hydrogen cars, which would be a good thing, then the only exhaust would be water. But anyway, that's an exergonic reaction like you'd expect for the burning of a fuel, right? There's a big change in G. That's what this vertical distance represents, a delta G. High G originally, very much lower G at the end. So it's highly exergonic, which is why the Hindenburg blew up. That was because they were using hydrogen. That's if you do this all in one step. That'll release a lot of energy all at once. And that would kill the cell. And even if it didn't kill the cell, it wouldn't be a manageable amount of energy, and so you wouldn't get a chance of capturing a great deal of that to make ATP. But you can do the same thing in multiple steps rather than just one big step. That's what cells do. That's what's shown on the right. This is where we are like the multi-step thermoelectric plant. There's multiple movements of electrons through what is called the electron transport chains, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But that releases a little bit of energy at a time. Instead of killing the cell, it allows for a manageable amounts of energy to be put to use rather than just cause heat in the form of making more and more ATP. And so that's the big payoff for allowing this to happen. But it's the same exact overall change in G, the same delta G. If you do it in one step or multiple steps, it doesn't matter what you do in between. Delta G depends only on the initial and final G, not the path that you take. So it's the same overall change in energy. Oh, by the way, notice oxygen's involvement here. Oxygen in a combustion reaction gets what? Reduced or oxidized? Well, in a combustion reaction, what gets oxidized in general? Did I say? The fuel. Oxygen's not the fuel. Hydrogen, glucose, whatever is the fuel. So oxygen gets reduced. It gets reduced because it receives the electrons from the hydrogens from the fuel. And that turns it into water. That's why the end product is water. Oxygen, to start with, receives electrons from hydrogen, receives hydrogen, in other words, to become water. That's true here, too, as well. Except the hydrogen that came from the fuel, glucose, the electron and a proton that make up that hydrogen temporarily get separated from each other. The electrons go down electron transport chains. The hydrogens go a different route that we'll talk about. But then eventually, not necessarily those two, but eventually proton and electron get combined into hydrogen again to become part of water. Oxygen gets reduced into water in this overall process. All right, so that brings us to 9. where we can finally start talking about the particulars of this overall complete oxidation of glucose. So you see the summary slide for the complete process here. And the last time I said that the complete process consists of two major parts, each of which has many steps in it, but the two major parts of the complete oxidation of glucose are glycolysis first, shown here in this teal box, and then followed by cellular respiration, which is represented by this mitochondria. And that's because glycolysis, the first part of the complete oxidation of glucose, occurs out in the cytoplasm, in the cytosol, the liquid part of the cytoplasm, which is the kind of brownish background here. That represents, you know, this is, we're in the cell, but we're not in the mitochondrion. So that's where glycolysis occurs, not in a mitochondrion, out in the cytosol. And there are 10 steps to glycolysis, so the detail isn't shown here, but these multiple arrows indicate that it's a pathway, not a single reaction. And glycolysis is named for the fact that it splits glucose. It splits sugar. Glyco means sugar, and lysis means splitting. This is the beginning of the use of the fuel. It's the beginning of the dismantling of the carbon skeleton. All right? So, in 10 steps, known as glycolysis or the glycolytic pathway, what is accomplished is that the single 6-carbon glucose, which is the fuel, the original fuel, gets broken into 2 3-carbon compounds identical to each other called pyruvate. Pyruvate is still fuel. You should think of it as partially spent fuel. Glucose, the original fuel, pyruvate has less energy in it because you partially dismantled the carbon skeleton of the original fuel, but you haven't completely dismantled it yet. That's why pyruvate is still valuable stuff. And therefore, if all you do is glycolysis to make pyruvate, you've only extracted some of the usable energy out of that original glucose. That's why it's only part of the complete oxidation of glucose. And therefore, that little bit of energy can make some ATP for you, can be put to use making ATP, and that's why you see ATP at the bottom here coming out of the glycolysis box. But pyruvate still has a lot more energy in it that you can get out if you continue after glycolysis. That's what cellular respiration is all about. Cellular respiration begins where glycolysis ends. But it happens, cellular respiration that is, inside a mitochondrion. All right, now, let's look at the inputs and outputs specifically of glycolysis. I already told you a little of this. The inputs are the fuel itself, glucose. You also, though, have to have NAD plus as an input into glycolysis. It's not explicitly shown here, but NAD plus is the oxidized form, right? The empty taxis. Those are the material inputs. The outputs are pyruvate, the partially spent fuel, 3 carbons each, and reduced coenzymes, NADHs, NH pluses. Okay? And keep in mind, they're carrying a lot of energy. Well, the energy came from glucose. Some of the electrons get picked off of glucose in this process of glycolysis, and they get put onto NAD plus, which is the oxidized form, to reduce it into NADH and H plus. That's an output. So notice the arrow here is coming out of glycolysis. All right? And the other output is ATP. I should have told you that another input, I'm sorry, is ADP, right? The lower energy form compared to ATP of that energy-carrying molecule. And then that gets converted into ATP. So ADP, NADH, ADP, NAD plus, and glucose are inputs. Pyruvate, ATP, and NADH and H plus are outputs. And that all happens out in the cytosol, not in a mitochondria. ATP that's produced by glycolysis is no different from ATP produced anywhere else, and that is the goal. So that stuff is done. It's ready to go to be used for whatever endergonic process needs to be powered. The pyruvate's not done, and the NADH is not done, because the pyruvate still has energy that can be extracted, and the NADHs are just taxis that need to deliver the energy that they're carrying to a later part of the process, namely cellular respiration itself. Okay, so that's not the goal yet. All right, cellular respiration is, in the overall process, part two, right, of two parts. Glycolysis, cellular respiration. Glycolysis has 10 steps within it. Cellular respiration is broken into three major parts in itself. So there's three parts to part two. And those three parts are not all explicitly listed here. Steps two and three are, but the first step is represented just by this white arrow. And that first part of cellular respiration is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's obviously something that's being done to pyruvate, right? Which makes sense because of what I told you a little bit ago. Cellular respiration starts where glycolysis ends. Well, glycolysis ends with pyruvate. And keep in mind, for each individual glucose that enters the process, that enters glycolysis, there are going to be two pyruvates that cellular respiration will start with. Right? So if you think about these things in a per glucose way, there's one glucose entering. Now when you get to cellular respiration, everything happens twice because there's two pyruvates created out of that one glucose originally. But it makes sense that the first part of cellular respiration is something that's happening to pyruvate, because that's the starting molecule for cellular respiration. And it's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate that is step one. I'll explain why that name makes sense when we look at that at a different slide. The second part, though, or subpart of cellular respiration, is the citric acid cycle. The citric acid cycle can be called that, or CAC. It can also be called the Krebs cycle, after a human, and that name, it's an eponym. They don't really tell you anything about it because it's just a human's name. Or it can be called the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Which can be abbreviated the TCA cycle. Those are all interchangeable names. Krebs cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle, citric acid cycle. That's part two of cellular respiration. Part three is called oxidative phosphorylation. But part three, which is already a subpart of part two of the overall process, is itself broken into two subparts. Oxidative phosphorylation consists of these two pieces: electron transport and chemiosmosis. Okay? Together, those two make up the third part of cellular respiration, oxidative phosphorylation. Now, all of that, all three of those parts of cellular respiration occur in a mitochondrion, not out in the cytosol like glycolysis does. In terms of goals, notice that two of these three parts of cellular respiration produce ATP. The citric acid cycle produces ATP, and so does oxidative phosphorylation. The first part of cellular respiration doesn't produce any ATP, but it does valuable stuff that we'll look at in a minute. Like I said, all ATP is identical, but the way that the ATP is produced in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle is different from the way that it's produced in oxidative phosphorylation. You can see that by the labels below them. It's the same stuff, but it's produced in different ways. In glycolysis and the citric acid cycle, the ATP gets produced by what is called substrate level phosphorylation, which is a name that makes sense involving a substrate, and I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. But in oxidative phosphorylation, that's a different way of producing ATP that we'll look at the particulars of also. Not only is it produced in a different way compared to substrate level, but this bigger balloon around ATP indicates that by far most of the ATP that gets produced from the energy coming from one glucose is produced in this final step, oxidative phosphorylation. This is the really big payoff at the end. And that's why it's so valuable to not stop at glycolysis if you don't have to, and go on and keep processing the fuel in cellular respiration, so you get a hell of a lot more ATP out of it, out of this glucose, same glucose. Okay, that's the summary. Let's start looking at the particulars. In slide 10, though, before the particulars, we get a look at what substrate level phosphorylation means. This is how ATP is produced in glycolysis, which is not part of cellular respiration, and it's how it's produced in the citric acid cycle, which is part of cellular respiration. Substrate level phosphorylation simply means that a substrate is carrying a phosphate originally. That's the green thing with the phosphate on it. And what makes it a substrate? The fact that it binds to an enzyme. And when it binds to an enzyme at the active site, the phosphate gets transferred from the substrate to an ADP, which is also a substrate, by the way, because it's also binding to the enzyme. But the phosphate gets transferred from this green substrate to the ADP. In other words, ADP in this process is becoming phosphorylated. An additional phosphate is being added, and that's why the end result is ATP. ADP gets phosphorylated into ATP. That's charging it with more energy than it already had. ADP already has usable energy, but now it has even more in the form of ATP. And that's the goal of this overall process. Where did that energy come from? Well, it was in glucose as the fuel originally. But before then, where was it? In sunlight. Right? It was the energy of sunlight that gets transformed into the chemical energy of the sugars produced by the photosynthetic organism. Now, the photosynthetic organism could be using the fuel, or it could be one of us animals that ate that plant that's using it as fuel. The point is, it came from sunlight originally. Now, this energy, though, is in the form of ATP. It's no longer in the fuel. And now it can be used, when ATP gets spent, to do any kind of thing that ATP can power that's endergonic. But that's the essence of substrate level phosphorylation. We'll see later how that's quite a bit different from how ATP, most of the ATP in cellular respiration gets produced in that final step. But first, let's go to slide 11 and start talking about the steps involved in this overall process. Here we see glycolysis. This is a brief version of glycolysis. Not all the details are shown here. I told you earlier that glycolysis is a 10-step pathway, so there are 10 reactions end-to-end linked. And not all those details are shown here, but this is kind of a balance sheet. Those 10 reactions that make up glycolysis can be divided into two major phases based on what's happening to energy. Those phases are called the energy investment phase and the energy payoff phase. And the energy investment phase is called this because instead of producing ATP, this part of glycolysis actually requires ATP. ATP has to be put into the situation in order for this part of glycolysis to happen. You have to invest the ATP in order to cause glycolysis to happen, which seems contrary to what your goal is, right? Your goal is to make ATP, and right away you have to spend ATP without making any. But it's like the analogy of the old phrase about money. It takes money to make money. You have to invest money if you want to earn interest. But eventually the payoff is worth it. So the energy that's in the ATP that gets spent in the energy investment phase get invested into the fuel molecule, energizing the fuel, and that allows the fuel then to go through the rest of glycolysis, which is the energy payoff phase. So notice in the investment phase, these are all per glucose. 2 ATP get invested. You have to spend 2 ATP per glucose. But then in the energy payoff phase, there's 4 ATP that get built. That's why it's worth it. You have to spend 2 ATP to make 4 ATP. So in the balance sheet, the net on the bottom, you end up making 2 net ATP, which is worth it, of course. And if that's all the cell does, which is sometimes the case, sometimes that's all it can do is in terms of making ATP is glycolysis, that's all you'll get of usable energy out of glucose as the original fuel, just 2 ATP per glucose. But the complete balance sheet has inputs and outputs, right? You input glucose. When glycolysis is done, you have 2 pyruvates and 2 waters. All right? You have to put in 2 ATPs, but you produce 4 ATPs, so a net gain is 2. And don't forget about the coenzymes that are involved in this process. Never forget about NAD and the other coenzyme we haven't talked about yet. NAD plus comes in. That's the empty taxi, right? It's coming in to pick up passengers from the fuel in the form of hydrogens. So when that happens, the full taxi is the output, NADH and H plus. And there's 2 taxis per glucose that get filled up. So 2 NADHs, that's a lot of energy, because each individual NADH has enough energy to make multiple ATPs eventually. All right, so that's where we are for glycolysis. Let's look at the individual reactions in slide 12. Now, if this were a biochemistry course, I would expect you to learn all of these individual reactions, but that's not really so important in this course. I just want to explain some major things that are going on. We're not looking at all of glycolysis here. We're only looking at the energy investment phase, right? Just half of the overall 10-step pathway, basically. But glucose is at the top. You have a certain number of steps. Notice each step is associated with its own enzyme, because each step is a reaction, right? Specific enzyme for each specific step. And the very first thing is to convert glucose into what is called phosphoglucoisomerase. It's a phosphorylated glucose. That's why you have to spend energy right away in the form of ATP. To spend ATP means to dephosphorylate the ATP, right? To split a phosphate off of it. In this case, the phosphate is used to phosphorylate the fuel. That's why it's no longer just glucose, it's phosphoglucose. I'm sorry, phosphoglucoisomerase is the enzyme name. Glucose-6-phosphate is the fuel at this point. And that phosphorylation of the fuel is part of the energy investment. It's still a 6-carbon fuel, right? It's just phosphorylated at this point. So you haven't broken anything apart yet. In fact, you've added to it by phosphorylating it. Then, in these next steps, it is really just a rearrangement of these existing atoms. In other words, you turn one isomer into another. because isomers have exactly the same number and types of atoms, right? So glucose-6-phosphate becomes fructose-6-phosphate, same chemical formula, but it's a rearrangement. And then that gets turned into fructose-1,6-bisphosphate because another ATP gets spent to phosphorylate it again. This bisphosphate means there are two phosphates there. So now we have still a six-carbon fuel, but it's doubly phosphorylated at this point. Then we get to this fork in the road. And that is where we're finally going to split a six-carbon fuel into three-carbon fuels. All right? Now notice it's a fork in the road, meaning there's two possibilities here. When this fructose-1,6-bisphosphate gets split, it can be either dihydroxyacetone phosphate or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate that get produced. Notice that they're both three-carbon compounds. See their structural formula? Oh, actually, it's much bigger right here. They're both three-carbon compounds. Either one is possible, and the cell doesn't really know which one's going to happen. They're both about equal probability because they're about the same energy. The thing is, though, when we look at the next slide, which is the rest of the pathway, the rest of glycolysis, specifically the energy payoff phase, that has to have only one of these as the starting point of the rest of it. That's why there's an arrow going down here, but not here. In other words, the fuel has to be in the form of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate to go on to the rest of glycolysis. It can't be in the form of dihydroxyacetone phosphate. That's no problem, though, because even if dihydroxyacetone phosphate is produced, which it will randomly, it can easily be converted into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. That's what these side arrows are all about. These are exactly the same chemical formula, so they're isomers of each other. And if you make this instead of the stuff that can continue on, then you just turn this into the stuff that can continue on. In other words, you turn one isomer into another, and that's why the enzyme is called isomerase that does that job. But the split has occurred here. You started with six carbon fuel. Now you have two three-carbon fuels. So it's two of these glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates that go on, not just one, right? Because you split the fuel. So everything that we're going to look at in this next slide is happening twice, once each for these two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, which can be abbreviated as G3P. Let's go look at that then in slide 13. This is the energy payoff phase. This is what makes it worth it. This arrow at the top is just continuing down from the G3P part of the fork in the road. All right, so you have two of those. And that's why you have everything multiplied by two here. It's not just one NAD plus, it's two individual NAD pluses, two empty taxis, one coming to pick up hydrogens from each of the two G3Ps. Okay, that's an empty taxi. It's becoming reduced into NADH and H plus because it's picking the hydrogens off of that G3P fuel. Okay, and same is happening to the other version of it. Then you also are able to phosphorylate an ADP into ATP for each of the two fuels. That's why it's two here. Everything happens. These are per glucose, right? So for each glucose, you have two of this second part happening. And that's a lot of energy that you have stored that is not wasted as heat. That's put into useful form. Reduced coenzymes, NADH and H+, and phosphorylated nucleotides, ATP. That's valuable stuff. Okay, then you do some more rearrangement and then get another couple of ATP out of it. That's why it's four overall. Two here, two here. or really one here and one here, but for each of the two fuel molecules once it's split. So four overall. And you've spent two to get there, remember, though, so that's why you're only earning two net ATP, but you've also, importantly, earned two NADH and H+, which is even more valuable than the ATP in terms of energy. But when you get to the end, that is pyruvate. The end of glycolysis is pyruvate. Two of them, though, right? You have to have two three-carbon compounds when you start with one six-carbon compound. So there's two of these as well. That is glycolysis. That happened out in the cytosol. The pyruvate is not completely spent fuel, right? It's only partially spent fuel because we haven't completely dismantled this carbon skeleton and we haven't completely picked off the hydrogens. That's why it's still valuable. But it's done as far as glycolysis is concerned. It's the output. And that is what cellular respiration is going to take in as a starting point, the pyruvate. All right, well, let's go to cellular respiration then, slide 14. Remember that I said that the first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Pyruvate's the starting molecule, and this is a pyruvate. It is still out in the cytosol at this point, so this is fresh off of the glycolysis pathway. This is what we have now as fuel, though. Well, This structural formula of pyruvate shows you that it's a three-carbon compound, but also notice that one of those carbons is double bonded to an O and single bonded to another O. Now, this has been deprotonated because of the pH of the cell, but if you had a proton here still, you would have an OH, right? Instead of an O negative. This is just the electron of the hydrogen atom, not the proton as well. But at different pH, that would be an OH. What would you call this functional group? C double bonded to an O and also bonded to an OH. You're not allowed to forget the functional groups, even though we tested on them already. No, a carbonyl is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen just by itself. Carboxyl. And what do you suppose the word is for removing a carboxyl? Decarboxylation. Just like dehydrogenation is removal of hydrogen from a fuel. Right? So the pyruvate, which includes three carbons, one of which is involved in a carboxyl group, gets decarboxylated. That's the next part of the dismantling of the carbon skeleton, but it's the first part of cellular respiration in which that happens. Well, cellular respiration entirely happens within the mitochondrion. So part of this first process, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, is the importation of pyruvate into the mitochondrion from the cytosol, represented by this white arrow. So it has to pass through both membranes. Remember, the mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. So it has to go through the outer membrane, through the intermembrane space, and then through the inner membrane to get to the yellow background, which is the mitochondrial matrix. This inner compartment is called the mitochondrial matrix. That's part of the process, just getting the fuel into the mitochondrion. But in the process, notice that it becomes decarboxylated. You take off a carbon and two oxygens. Since the carboxyl is deprotonated at this point, it's just really two oxygens. You have carbon dioxide. So decarboxylation decarboxylates the fuel, but what comes out is carbon dioxide. This is why carbon dioxide is a waste product of cellular respiration. This is completely spent fuel, CO2. Does you no good in terms of energy, which is why you exhale it. The cells of your body are continuously producing CO2 by burning your fuels. It builds up, gets sent to the blood, diffuses into the blood. Blood carries it to the lungs. It diffuses into the air in the lungs, and we exhale it. All right. But the carbon dioxide represents one of the carbons of the six that were in the fuel originally. The carbon dioxide that we exhale comes from the food that we ate. All right, so that's the decarboxylation part of this word, of this name of the process. It's oxidative decarboxylation, though, because it's a redox reaction involved as well. Specifically, a redox reaction involving another one of these taxis, another NAD. So you have here in this process NAD plus, empty taxi, oxidized version, picking up hydrogen to become the reduced form, NADH and H plus. So it becomes energized. The taxi is now carrying energy that was in the pyruvate molecule. Okay? Valuable stuff. Remember, it's carrying more energy than ATP. But in this particular part of cellular respiration, no ATP is produced. The energy, but it gets stored, though, in the form of NADH, which is carrying even more energy than ATP. So it's, don't forget about that. It's valuable. What's left over after all this happens is what we see on the right. Actually, what we see on the right just below the SCOA. This part is what remains of the fuel, which is an acetyl group. Okay, only two carbons. So the fuel, which at this point started out as pyruvate that came from glucose originally, but it's pyruvate at the beginning of cellular respiration, it has now been further dismantled in terms of the carbon skeleton. Now we only have two carbons left because the third carbon is in carbon dioxide. Okay? And if you don't include this squiggly line in what's above it, this is just an acetyl. That's the remaining part of the fuel, still valuable, hasn't been completely dismantled yet. Less energy than pyruvate, but we've already gotten some more energy out of pyruvate in the form of NADH and H+. That acetyl group needs to be picked up by another kind of taxi and delivered to the second part of cellular respiration. And this other taxi is another coenzyme. Right? These coenzymes are picking things up and dropping them off. This one is called coenzyme A, which is what CoA is short for. Coenzyme A by itself is just this brown thing. That's the empty taxi. But it picks up what's left of the fuel after it gets decarboxylated. And that's the acetyl group. And therefore, when this taxi is full, we call it not just coenzyme A, but acetyl coenzyme A. In other words, it's a taxi with the remaining fuel as a passenger. Now, is that making sense? It's a lot of details, I know, but go ahead.
So the NADH is meant to be, but it has potential to become ATP?
Well, it's not going to itself be turned into ATP, but it's going to give up the energy it's carrying so that we can power the process of sticking another phosphate onto ADP to make ATP. And that's in the final stage of cellular respiration, the big payoff, oxidative phosphorylation. For now, though, it's valuable because it's carrying a bunch of the energy that was in glucose originally. But it took it, in this case, directly from what's left of the fuel after glycolysis, which was pyruvate. All right? Go ahead.
With the NADH and the H plus, the CH3 doesn't get removed in that process?
Not this, no. This is still part of the acetyl.
Okay.
And that's going to be removed coming up in step two.
Okay, because I thought during the process of the NAD plus becoming the NADH, I thought that's when the hydrogen gets removed.
Not this hydrogen, though. This hydrogen is still part of acetyl,
right.
It's going to be removed by other coenzymes in the citric acid cycle, which is the next part.
Okay.
And the CO2 that's produced here is really two CO2s, because keep in mind, everything is multiplied by two when you think of it per glucose. glucose split into two pyruvates, so there's two oxidative decarboxylations of pyruvate happening independently but simultaneously in a mitochondrion. And therefore, per glucose, it's two CO2s and two NADHs that are produced and two acetyl coenzyme A's. All right? Let's look at this next part, slide 15. This is a simplified version of the citric acid cycle or tricarboxylic acid cycle or Krebs cycle. Actually, it's more than that. I shouldn't say it's just a cycle. This is actually parts 1 and 2 of cellular respiration. The oxidative decarboxylation of glucose is shown as this non-cyclic arrow at the top. And the fuel is just, for simplicity, shown as carbons. But the oxygens and the hydrogens are there as well, of course. You start with a 3-carbon pyruvate, two of them, everything's repeated. But for each pyruvate, you take off one of the carbons in the form of CO2. You reduce NAD plus into NADH, that's what the stuff we just went through, and you're left with a 2-carbon fuel that gets picked up by coenzyme A, making it into acetyl coenzyme A, and the destination for that taxi is to drop off the acetyl to step 2, which is the citric acid cycle. Now, the coenzyme A, does not enter the citric acid cycle. It just drops off the fuel, the acetyl. Okay? And that's going to empty this coenzyme A, and it can go back up and get more and keep going back and forth, like taxis do. The 2-carbon fuel, though, is what enters the cycle. And it's still fuel, still valuable, even though there's only 2 carbons left. It hasn't been completely dismantled and completely dehydrogenated yet. That's why it is still valuable. So the details of the citric acid cycle are not shown step by step, but the important stuff is what the citric acid cycle accomplishes is the rest of the dismantling of the fuel. You only have 2 pieces of 2-carbon compounds, right? 2 acetyls left. So the citric acid cycle completely dismantles those. And that's why you can see carbon dioxide coming off of here. 1 carbon dioxide from 1 acetyl and another carbon dioxide from the other acetyl. That's why it's 2 carbon dioxides. All right? And in the process, more NAD plus gets reduced into NADH and H plus. And a second kind of coenzyme that I was talking about earlier, that I said we would get to, also gets reduced. So this, it's like a taxi in a different company's fleet. It's doing the same job, but it's not exactly the same molecule. This is FAD, which stands for flavin adenine dinucleotide. Very similar, but the nitrogenous base on this one that carries the electrons is not nicotinamide, instead it's flavin. Okay? FAD is the oxidized form, that's the empty taxi. FADH2 is the reduced form. Notice the difference here. The oxidized form of NAD is NAD plus, which is why it could take only one of the protons, because it takes one electron just to make it neutral and then an electron and a proton to make the hydrogen. This one, though, doesn't start off as plus. It starts off as just FAD. So it can take all 4 pieces. It can take 2 entire hydrogen atoms, 2 electrons and 2 protons, and that turns it into FADH2. There's no leftover proton. So it's doing the same job. It's temporarily storing energy that was originally in glucose, but now is coming directly from the remaining fuel, which is the acetyl. And it's just temporary storage because the goal is ATP production. Both NADH and H+ and FADH2 are going to now deliver, after the citric acid cycle, are going to deliver all of this energy they've been carrying from different places to the final part of cellular respiration, which is when most of the ATP gets produced, using the energy that these taxis are carrying. But along the way in the citric acid cycle, in addition to reducing these coenzymes, which is carrying most of the energy, some of the energy that's released in the constituent reactions of the cycle get used to phosphorylate ADP into ATP. So ATP is produced in the citric acid cycle. Remember, it wasn't in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. All we did in that step, other than the decarboxylation, was to reduce NAD plus into NADH. Valuable, but no ATP produced directly in there. Here we produce ATP plus we reduce more coenzymes. And the ATP that gets produced here is also produced via substrate level phosphorylation, just like it was in glycolysis. In other words, a phosphorylated substrate passes its phosphate onto ADP to make it ATP. All right? It's a cycle, though. So it is a pathway, but it's a pathway that the end of which loads the beginning again. It's like a start-finish line. And therefore can continue as long as you keep adding acetyl carried by coenzyme A from the first part to this second part. So that doesn't really show you all the details, but that's the important part as far as what's happening to the fuel. Speaking of fuel, though, as I said, citric acid cycle completes the oxidation, completes the breakdown, dismantling of the fuel, which is why all we have at this point, CO2, no more fuel at all after the citric acid cycle. You have two CO2s produced here, times two, actually, plus two CO2s from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, for a total of six CO2s at this point. You have all six carbons accounted for that were originally in glucose. All right? I think I misspoke before when I said this two means... This two is not because there's two acetyls. It's two per acetyl because there's two carbons, each of which becomes a CO2. But you multiply this two by two to mean four overall from the glucose, two from this step, for a total of six. Therefore, the complete dismantling of the fuel has already happened by the end of the citric acid cycle. You have no more fuel left, meaning no more energy that you can extract from that. It's just worthless CO2, worthless from the energetic perspective. But the process is not complete, right? You haven't made very much ATP yet, which is the goal. You made a little bit of ATP in glycolysis via substrate level phosphorylation. You made none in the first part of cellular respiration. You made a little bit more here in the second part, the citric acid cycle. That's not very much ATP compared to how much energy has been extracted from the fuel that is now gone. So where is that energy? In the form of the reduced coenzymes. These taxis that have been filling up the whole time, right? NAD plus got reduced in glycolysis, filled up as a taxi to NADH and H plus. That's part of the energy. More NADH and H plus is produced in the first part of cellular respiration, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And even more coenzymes and two types of coenzymes get reduced here in the citric acid cycle. So the still usable but not yet in the form of ATP energy from glucose originally is in the form of NADH and H plus, FADH2 from various points along the way. Okay? That's why you need more steps, even though the fuel is already gone at this point. You just need to have the final payoff by having these taxis deliver that energy. Well, let's look at the details in 16 of the citric acid cycle. Just like for glycolysis, I don't want you to memorize all these intermediates, but it does show you that it's multiple steps in a pathway that ends at the beginning. It wraps around. Now, this will continue only if you add more fuel, because remember, it can't just go by itself since you're taking things off along the way. You have to keep adding as well. But this thing is called the citric acid cycle because the first thing, this is basically the start-finish line at the top here at 12 o'clock position, this first compound in the intermediates is citrate, which is a deprotonated form of citric acid. If this was had another proton, it's COOH, it would be citric acid. That's why it's called the citric acid cycle. All right, but notice that citrate or citric acid is a six-carbon compound. The finish line is oxaloacetate. It's a four-carbon compound. All right? And think about what this citric acid cycle is trying to accomplish. It's trying to complete the dismantling of the skeleton, right? But it seems like it's doing just the opposite, because the two carbons that are in acetyl, which is what's left of the fuel, get delivered to oxaloacetate, which has four carbons in it, to produce a six-carbon compound, citrate. That's the opposite of dismantling, right? You're making a bigger carbon skeleton. But that's just so that it can then be broken down, and eventually CO2s get popped off along the way. The CO2s come from these intermediates, but they really come ultimately from the fuel. The fuel becomes temporarily part of these intermediates, and then those intermediates get decarboxylated. So that's how the citric acid cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel. There is no fuel remaining. All you have left are CO2s that came from citric acid cycle and from the previous step, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. But along the way, importantly, you have three different steps that reduce NAD plus into NADH, carrying a lot of energy. And you have one step that reduces FAD into FADH2, carrying a lot of energy. Plus, in this step at the bottom, you have substrate level phosphorylation of an ADP to make ATP. By the way, this is kind of an indirect process. It depends on the species. Some species have their citric acid cycle directly phosphorylate ADP. Other species, like us, use GDP as an intermediate. GDP is just like ATP, only using guanine instead of adenine for its nitrogenous base. But the GDP here picks up the phosphate from the fuel, turns it into GTP, and then GTP in turn passes its phosphate on to ADP to make ATP. It's just an indirect process, but still the end result is ATP. And ATP is the goal. These ones are valuable, but they're not the goal yet. That's why we need another step, another part of cellular respiration. Okay, 17. This is kind of a double duty slide because it's a graph, as you can see. And the y-axis here is free energy. So G, that's one use of the figure, but it's also kind of an anatomical figure in a sense, showing you all these different particles, including these big protein complexes. And there's four protein complexes here, labeled as Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, and 4. That should be IV. It just got messed up text-wise. Okay? All of this stuff in purple, collectively, is one electron transport chain. And a lot of textbooks will talk about the electron transport chain as though there's one of them. There's millions of them. They're just copies of each other. So this is one electron transport chain for cellular respiration. And physically, what it consists of are these major protein complexes and other smaller particles that move electrons around, or that pass electrons around. It's called the electron transport chain because it's electrons specifically that get passed from one member of the chain to the next. And it's an old-fashioned analogy, but it's like a bucket brigade. You know what I mean by a bucket brigade? the old-fashioned way of dealing with a fire, right? If there's no fire department showing up in a rural place, you have a well, the only sense of source of water, and the barn's on fire, then you get a bunch of neighbors in a bucket brigade just lined up. Rather than running back and forth and tiring yourself out, they'll stay in one position, and the person by the well fills up the bucket, passes it on to the next person, and so on. The final person throws it onto the fire, and then you just keep passing it along. Well, here, though, it's an electron brigade, in a sense, because it's electrons, not buckets of water, that get passed from one member to the next. And that involves these four major protein complexes that make up the chain. Anatomically, these protein complexes are embedded in, part of, the inner mitochondrial matrix, the inner mitochondrial membrane. Okay, so that's where you find all these millions of copies of this thing. They are part of that inner membrane. And the more copies of these you have, the more efficiently you can have them do their job, right? Simultaneously. This should explain to you why the inner mitochondrial membrane is so big. It's folded up, right, into Christi. That maximizes the surface area so you can hold a lot more copies of these electron transport chains. So they can all be operating simultaneously, processing energy that came from the fuel. The electron transport process, which is what the electron transport chains do, is the first of the two parts of this final phase of cellular respiration. So let's reorient ourselves here. We have the overall process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose, right? Two parts to that: glycolysis, cellular respiration. Cellular respiration then has three parts: oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, citric acid cycle, and oxidative phosphorylation. We're now in that third part, oxidative phosphorylation, and it has two parts: electron transport and chemiosmosis. This is the electron transport process of it, part of it. Okay? Now, what is the source of the electrons that get passed down the chain? Well, you can look and see, but what would you guess it is based on what I've been telling you all along? Right, the two kinds of coenzymes that got reduced along the way in the earlier parts. And the taxis that are carrying these valuable electrons that represent energy that was originally in glucose are now finally at their destination. And they're going to drop those passengers off. Those passengers are electrons. Actually, electrons and protons, but not held together as hydrogen atoms anymore. Electrons and protons get delivered. But it's the electrons, not the protons, that get passed from one member of the chain to the next. That's why you have NADH coming in, dropping off electrons, and that reoxidizes the NADH back into NAD+. It empties the taxi. And the same thing is happening with FADH2, dropping off its two electrons. So that's the source of the electrons. Where were those electrons originally? In glucose. But they got picked up along the way by these oxidized coenzymes to produce those coenzymes. Since this is electron transport that's happening, what can you say is happening chemically? If electrons are getting transported, what's happening? What kind of process? Well, this first member of the chain, complex 1, is receiving electrons from NADH. How would you describe that chemically? Right. It's a redox, a series of redox reactions. Because when this first member of the chain receives electrons, it becomes reduced. but it's not going to hang on to those electrons, right? It's going to pass them to the next member of the chain. That's going to oxidize the first member and reduce the second member, and so on down the line. So it's a series of redox reactions because electrons keep getting transported. This is where the graph aspect of this figure comes into play, because this kind of, showing you these protein complexes shows you that it's a real material thing, but putting them on the graph the way they are situated shows you that there's different values of G that are associated with these members. When the electron gets passed from one member to the next, it's not just being transported to a new thing, it's getting closer to an atomic nucleus. Therefore, it's going down in energy. Each of these little steps is downward in the graph, going to a lower G value. So this is analogous to the multi-step hydroelectric power plant. Instead of releasing it all at once, a little bit of energy is released each time an electron gets transported to the next member of the chain. Okay, but graphically, that means you're getting lower in Y value, lower G. Look at where NADH and FADH2 are, though. NADH is able to deliver its electrons to member 1, complex 1. FADH2 can't. It has to deliver it to member 2. A little bit later in the process, which is at a lower G already. And that's why the FADH2 coenzyme is not really carrying quite as much usable energy as NADH, because not as much electron transport will happen as a result of it delivering its electrons. It's like giving a bucket to someone in the middle of the line, basically. Okay. Speaking of the bucket brigade again, that's only going to... Oh, I got to stop. Why didn't you stop me?